Good morning.
The first case for oral argument this morning is Carlin and Associates and Gary Peterson Appellants versus James B. Osman Appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Kimberly Dorsett, an attorney from Aberdeen. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Robert Spears, an attorney from Watertown. I'd like to welcome the students from Loyola High School, and I hope you find this an informative session. Surely maybe after the oral arguments, I think we have some booklets that maybe one of the booklets, if we can find them, is a pictorial history of the Supreme Court of South Dakota. And then there's a blue-covered booklet that also explains how the legal system in South Dakota operates. What will happen this morning is Ms. Dorsett, who is the representing the appellant, will have 20 minutes to make a presentation to the court as to why the trial court erred. And then Mr. Spears will be allowed 20 minutes to attempt to convince the court why the trial court's decision was correct. And then Ms. Dorsett has a 10-minute rebuttal period. So the entire process will take approximately 50 minutes. So with that, Ms. Dorsett, you may proceed.
May I please the court, opposing counsel? Again, my name is Kimberly Dorsett. I'm here representing the appellant in this case, Gary Peterson. We are here before this court seeking a reversal in its entirety of the judgment that was rendered against Gary Peterson and in favor of James Osman. We believe four separate grounds mandate this reversal. First of all being that the court should have granted directed verdict in favor of the defendants at the close of plaintiff's case in chief. Number two, we believe that the manual, which is trial exhibit number one, never should have been applied to create any contractual obligations between defendant Gary Peterson and plaintiff James Osman. Number three, we believe that that any remedy that this plaintiff would seek in this case is precluded under the doctrine of unclean hands. And number four, that the trial court's split of commissions in this case on a 60-40 basis is not factually supported in the record in this case. Now, there are some very important facts, undisputed nonetheless, that I think are very important to set out and keep in mind throughout the course of this argument. First of all, the relationship between these parties is critical in this case. At the top of a pyramid, so to speak, you have General Agent Dean Carlin, who was a defendant in this case. And I would remind the court that he was completely dismissed from any liability at the close of the trial. Underneath Dean Carlin is two independent agents that he recruited and trained, plaintiff James Osman and defendant Gary Peterson. Now, James Osman and Gary Peterson were not in any way, shape, or form related to each other. Their only commonality was happening to be recruited and trained by the same general agent, Dean Carlin. And these agents worked directly contracted with Security Financial Life to sell insurance. Now, a second and distinct separate business, again operated by Dean Carlin, was called Carlin & Associates Incorporated. And Carlin & Associates was also a named defendant, also dismissed by the trial court, leaving the only remaining defendant, Gary Peterson. And Carlin & Associates was formed by Dean Carlin solely for the purpose of selling, initially, DakotaCare, which is an HMO new to South Dakota. Dean Carlin was granted the exclusive right to sell DakotaCare in this area, and he created a separate corporation in order to do that because of the different rules, different production requirements, and he had to pool agents in order to meet the production requirements to keep his exclusive agency. And what Dean Carlin did in an effort to assist the agents that he would recruit and train is he developed what's called the manual, which you see as trial exhibit number one. Now, important fact to remember is Dean Carlin created and drafted this manual. And he did it, as he testified at trial, to mainly act as a guideline for agents, teach them how to be successful agents. And it was drafted after he formed Carlin & Associates, Inc. Gary Peterson had absolutely nothing to do with the drafting implementation of this manual. And the unrefuted testimony in the record is that Gary Peterson believed at all point in times and acted at all point in times as if the manual particularly paragraph 9, which is the commission split paragraph that brings us here today, only applied if you sold Carlin & Associates business, namely Dakota Care. He did not believe that paragraph applied to him because he only sold Security Financial Life, and that's how he acted at all times. And also, finally, I just want to point out that this gear product, which is a very complex tax, it's supposed to give some tax advantages to clients who have enough money to gain the tax advantage. It was purely Gary Peterson's specialty, and he's the only one who generated any interest with the Hellwigs in this case. He did all the work. He generated all the interest. Plaintiff James Osman never even said the word gear to the Hellwigs. So, again, Gary Peterson's the one that did all the work and generated all the interest. Now, the first argument concerning directed verdict is that the close of plaintiff's case in chief, you will find in the transcript that defendants made a strategic decision not to cross-examine James Osman. And we did that because at the close of plaintiff's case, he had not proven the essential elements of a contract. We had not in any way, shape, or form had any evidence to support that James Osman and Gary Peterson had in any way assented to form any type of contract. There was no proof as to any type of remedy that they were seeking. And in fact, you will find that a lot of the holes that were plugged in this contract, the elements that were needed to form a contract, were supplied by the defendant as they were trying to defend the case.
Did you get to argue that to the trial court?
We did, Your Honor.
What did the trial court say?
The trial court denied directed verdict as to the breach of contract claim, but did grant directed verdict as to the retaliatory discharge claim.
So did the trial court say there was a question of fact as to the existence of a contract, or did he find as a matter of law there was a contract?
At that point in time, he did not make that ruling. He just thought that the plaintiff had put on sufficient enough facts to at least get him over that hurdle and get him to the next stage. Excuse me. Our second argument concerns the fact that this manual, Trial Exhibit Number 1, should never have been applied to create a contract between independent insurance agent Gary Peterson and independent insurance agent James Osman. Now, I would point out to the court that finding of fact number 44, and I quote from the trial court here, defendant Gary Peterson is bound by the terms and conditions listed in paragraph 9, page 2 of the manual. And then in conclusion of law number 6, you will find, again, I'm quoting from the trial court, contractual obligations between defendant Peterson and the plaintiff by virtue of the fact that plaintiff was a full-time agent with defendants Carlin and Associates when the policy at issue was sold. Now, what this trial court has done is took this manual that was created by Dean Carlin, drafted by Dean Carlin, said, I'm going to find that this manual creates a contract, and it's going to be an implied contract. It has to be between defendant Dean Carlin and plaintiff James Osman because Dean Carlin drafted it. But then what the trial court did is then imposed that obligation upon an independent insurance agent, Gary Peterson. That's a completely improper application of basic contract law.
Didn't he indicate that it was an implied contract between everyone, including all the agents?
No, he did not. I mean, my interpretation of the findings of fact and conclusions of law is that is not what the trial court did.
The effect, though. I mean, isn't that the practical effect of what the trial court was saying? There was an implied contract among all these agents that were working on this side.
I believe if that were really the case, then why was Dean Carlin and Carlin Associates dismissed in their entirety as a defendant in the case? The only person left holding the bag was Gary Peterson, who had never any way assented or consented to be bound in that fashion.
Well, none of the other defendants didn't sell in the other end of the competition, they weren't entitled to a split under the manual. Isn't that the reason why the rest of them were dismissed? There were only two parties that were involved in the split here.
Correct.
Nobody else had a claim to a split.
Well, I would remind the court that the only theory pled in this case was a breach of contract. I think I see where you're going here, because if you wanted to impose an obligation upon Gary Peterson, it would have to have been under some third-party beneficiary theory. But that wasn't pled in this case. The only theory pled was breach of contract. So what you have to do is you have to apply all the elements of a contract between Gary and James. You can't impose a theory of law that was not pled in this case. We have a right to defend the case on the theory pled, which is a breach of contract. And those elements between defendant Gary Peterson and James Osmond were completely missing. Most importantly, consideration of mutual assent. Again, the unrefuted testimony presented at trial is that Gary Peterson at all points in time said, that manual did not apply to me. I never acted as if or believed that the paragraph 9 applied to me if I was selling security financial products. James Osmond obviously testified to a completely different view of what the manual did and what the manual applied to, but that in and of itself demonstrates that these parties never had a meeting of the mind. How can you then impose a contractual obligation between these two people? I mean, I suppose in theory, under some strained theory, Dean Carlin should have had some responsibility here, but he was dismissed as a defendant, and that ruling was not appealed. He's done. He's out. The civil form of res judicata applies to any theories that can be brought against Dean Carlin. Res judicata and collateral estoppel. So another problem that I have is that Osterkamp was wrongfully extended to this case. I mean, I would remind the court, Osterkamp versus Alcoa Manufacturing was a case where this court said employers, whether inadvertent or otherwise, can contractually limit themselves from discharging employees at will. They can do that by drafting a policy manual that contains enough specificity and other procedures that would say, employer, you've just contractually bound yourself to only discharge employees out for just cause. So Osterkamp never should have been applied in this case, because you will not find in any finding of fact or conclusion of law that any type of employee-employer relationship applied in this case. So Osterkamp doesn't even apply, doesn't give any authority in this case. But what this trial court did was then extended Osterkamp one more level and said, I'm going to apply this case to a group of independent insurance agents who are more akin to independent contractors. And then the case got extended one step further, and this trial court said, now we are going to find that Osterkamp supports the creation of contractual obligations between co-employees, co-independent agents, just because in and of itself they just happen to be associated with the same employer or with the same general agent as in this case. No other facts supported the creation of a contractual obligation between these parties other than they just happen to work for the same general agent. That's what this trial court did, and that's why this mandates reversal. Again, I would remind the court that Gary Peterson's own belief and own actions do not support any mutual assent in this case. You also
thought... Was there a culture, though, as I understand from reading the briefs, there was testimony from other agents that had been this sharing of commissions, and the trial court took that into consideration. What do you have to say about that?
Well, first of all, that testimony goes to a custom and practice in the industry. And I would remind the court that custom and practice can only fill in a missing terms. It cannot create a contract where otherwise one does not exist. So a missing term would be if two agents came together, sat down, negotiated, and mutually agreed to be bound with each other to split commissions. And then they walked away. They never had the final discussion about, well, what should the split be? That's where the custom and practice would be relevant. In this particular case, we didn't have James and Gary sitting down at any point in time agreeing to split any commissions. So the custom and practice, first of all, I don't believe is relevant to the situation between defendant Gary Peterson and plaintiff James Osmond.
Wouldn't it but also be evidence that the contract was being informed? Looked at the contract and was following, where they were following it because they were sharing the commission.
You will find in the record, Justice, that particularly the testimony of Dwayne Storley, that what these insurance agents were doing, if they were sharing commissions, is because they sat down together prior to the case and mutually agreed and discussed it and agreed as to how these things were going to be split. They created their own little contracts on a case-by-case basis. None of them, especially you'll see from Dwayne Storley, he did not do that because he believed he was bound to it in the manual. In fact, his unrefuted testimony also is that the manual, first of all, did not contractually bind me to ever share commissions. I had to agree to do that on my own if I chose to. And he also testified, interestingly enough, that paragraph 9 of the manual never applied to security financial business. That's unrefuted in the record, too. And that, again, is evidence that mutual assent was missing with Gary Peterson because he operated under the same belief that another agent did, Dwayne Storley. I think that's a very important fact in this case.
What did the trial court find as far as mutual assent?
Frankly, in reviewing the findings of fact and conclusions of law, I don't see any evidence or any findings that there was mutual assent between Gary Peterson and James Oscom. I didn't find it. I looked. And in fact, you will see in my proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, I specifically said that Gary Peterson did not assent because he did not believe the manual applied in that fashion, and he had never split commissions on that fashion before. That finding is not present in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. I would also point out to the court that, you know, I was preparing my brief. I was doing research. Obviously, opposing counsel was preparing their brief and doing research. And it now appears that neither party has been able to find any authority that, first of all, applies Ostercamp outside of an employee-employer situation. And I have most certainly not found any law that supports an application that a policy manual in any way, shape, or form contractually obligates co-employees to each other, or that contractually, as in this case, obligates co-independent insurance agents to each other, just solely because they happen to be present in the same office that their common general agent is. I think that's a very improper extension of the law in Ostercamp.
Well, obviously, the court thought there was a contract, and the contract, as I understand, talks about two kinds of splits, 50-50 and 80-20.
Correct.
I know you mentioned that as one of the points, and we're running out of time. I'd like to know what you thought on that. How could the court come up with a 60-40 when the contract that said it's person only talks about 80-20, 50-50?
I would again point out that we do not believe that any type of commission split is warranted in this case in any way, shape, or form. But what I had a problem with is that the manual never mandated any type of commission split. The remedy in the manual was you just had to be disassociated. If you didn't play well with others, you had to leave. The manual never imposed any type of specific commission split. Now the agents did testify about 50-50 and 80-20.
All right, so the contract never had those.
No, it did not. The 50-50, 80-20 was supplied as a custom and practice by the insurance agents who testified. Now, 50-50 applied if both agents sat down together, both worked on the case, both contributed to the sale of the case, and both did all the work necessary. James Osmond never did that in this case. 80-20 was more of a referral relationship where a classic example would be in this case where James Osmond, who had only ever sold whole life or term life policies in his life, did not understand the Gear product, had never sold the Gear product. If he had sat down with the Helwigs, if we accept the fact that the Helwigs were his captive insurance client forever, which I submit is incorrect, but let's assume that fact to be true. If he had sat down with the Helwigs and said, "Helwigs, I know you guys make a lot of money. I think you need some tax breaks, some tax advantages. I think I've kind of heard of this program called Gear. I don't sell it. I don't understand it. But one other insurance agent I know does. His name's Gary Peterson. I think you two should sit down." That's an 80-20 split where there is a referral type situation.
Did
but
any
that
agent
didn't happen
testify
in this case.
To the 60-40?
No.
So that's something just the court came up with on its own.
Yes. And I believe that's error because, again, a court's ruling has to be based upon the facts submitted at trial. The word 60-40 never appeared in the transcript before the court did that.
What did the trial court say? He thought that was a fair split?
Yes. I'm going to paraphrase to a certain extent, but some sort of implicit authority to impose a remedy where one otherwise doesn't exist. And I don't believe that to be the case because, again, the manual in and of itself, if that's going to create the contract, then the manual is going to supply the remedy, which is disassociation or termination, to use the plaintiff's own words at trial. The plaintiff at trial testified, if you didn't follow the rules of the manual, you were terminated. Even the plaintiff himself never testified that the manual supplied the remedy, that he was entitled to a 50-50 split.
Well, if we find that there is an implied contract in this case, then what would be the split that would be appropriate?
Well, I guess if this court were to find that an implied contract existed, it's even strained because I think at most it would be an 80-20 split. But even that doesn't apply because James Osmond never even said the word gear to the Hellwigs. I mean, if you're going to refer a case, then at least bring it up with them. But if we're going to do anything in this case, 80-20 is the most appropriate because it's under a referral type of relationship. James Osmond would not have been able to offer anything. He didn't understand Gear. He would not have been able to offer any meaningful assistance. He would have been just sitting there in the chair next to Gary as Gary sold it.
But that wasn't the concept of the that wasn't the concept at all of the manual. The manual provided that if one agent went to someone else's previously treated client or customer, then the referral, it was kind of like a referral in the dark. But in other words, if you went to somebody else's customer, which was the case here, whether it's not based on the gear, it's not based on the type of policy, it's based on who the customer was and who theoretically the customer belonged to before. So it isn't identified with the gear policy, you know, so you don't have to refer based on the gear policy. It would be enough if A went and sold to B's customers.
Correct. And I would just remind the court that all paragraph 9 says is that they should hold the interview and should split the case, which means the agents would then sit down and have to talk it over with each other. And those two agree and enter into a contract about what they're going to do.
Your time has expired. Thank you. Mr. Spears, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. We obviously think the ruling of the trial court, the decision Judge Von Wald made after a two-day trial to the bench in this case, was correct. Solid and well-reasoned in all respects, and should be affirmed by this court. And here's why. I think it's important, and I think the evidence showed at trial. The following points I'm going to make is that Jim Osmond was a conscientious, productive insurance agent for 10 years with Carlin & Associates. And during that time, he worked with Carlin & Associates. He was presented a policy manual. And he did his very best to endeavor to follow that manual during his 10-year tenure with Carlin & Associates. And obviously, the policy provision in dispute and why we're here pertains to the active clients of one agent when they are prospected or solicited, whether inadvertently, by chance, or intentionally, the active client list of a current agent in that office, currently working out of that office, and though that is protected. And I believe the evidence showed at trial through the testimony of even Dean Carlin himself, who obviously was dismissed at the close of the case, but I don't think that has any bearing on the final judgment of the trial court against defendant Gary Peterson. But that policy was always followed, at least as it pertained to Jim. In fact, there was many instances and examples that Jim testified at trial that he always split commissions if he came across the client of another agent. And again, including including Dean Carlin. And that split was 50-50. In fact, I think Jim testified at trial every time he split a commission. It was on a 50-50 basis. Now, the 80-20 factor, how that came into the trial was through the, as I recall, was through the testimony of Mr. Don Call. And he said in some cases where there's just a blind referral, for lack of a better word, and one agent does all the work, then the appropriate split is 80-20.
That's kind of the case here, isn't it? Is that one agent did all the work, but it was with somebody else's client.
Well, on the surface, that's exactly what happened, Your Honor. But why did that happen? There's also a lot of evidence and testimony at trial from everybody involved that Jim asked when he found out that his client was being prospective and solicited by defendant Gary Peterson. He asked to be brought in the case and assisted on it, and the policy wasn't enforced. He was told by Dean Carlin that that policy was not going to be enforced on this sale because of his lack of productivity, meaning my client, Jim Osmond's, up to that point in time, and there's too much money involved. Now, the reason for the lack of productivity in my client up to that point was earlier that year, he was diagnosed with skin cancer and had to take some time off work. So, on the one hand, it is true, it is a one agent did all the work, but Jim requested in plenty of time, and I think there's 29 trial exhibits that show, many of them show that there was plenty of work to be done on this case, and Jim was asking to be brought in it and assist, but they didn't do it. It was refused.
So how do we get to 60-40?
I think that in the when you read the transcript, and I believe it's from pages 300 to 325, when Judge Von Wald announces his decision from the bench, he was of the opinion, his rationale was, that the splits are 60-60, 80-20. He's going to pick 60-40. Because that would compensate the defendant, Gary Peterson, an extra 10% for the work he did, because he did do all the work. But yet, on the other hand, Jim should have been allowed to come into the picture. And my understanding is, in reading of the transcript, that the judge thought that was equitable, and we were satisfied with that and chose not to appeal it.
I thought the two understandings or traditions were either 80-20 or 50-50. Was there another custom out there for 60-40?
No, that was the judge's decision based on the evidence and the facts of this case as he announced it from the bench in his oral decision. And like I said, my client chose not to to appeal that. And I would submit to this court, as I suggested in my brief, there is actually no case that we could research directly on point. So by analogy, we gave examples of valuation cases on real estate property, on divorce situations, marital assets. And the rule of law seems to be, as established by well-settled precedent of this court, is that if the range is within the evidence presented at trial, it's not abuse of discretion to come up with the figures the judge did, and we respectfully submit that argument to support the judge's decision.
So you're saying it's a variation on the 50-50 rather than an upgrade from the 80-20?
That's what I believe. I think it's, for lack of a better term, if I had to put this in my own words, I think the judge heard the evidence. He looked at the at some of the pretrial briefs, and he was familiar with the facts. He heard 2 days of testimony from a lot of insurance agents. And for lack of a better term, he was balancing the equities. That's just my own interpretation of what the judge is doing. But like I just said, it was within the range of the evidence presented at the trial court. And I think it's sound, and I respectfully suggest that submit to you that you uphold it.
Now, as far as the consensual between these two independent agents, what do you think the evidence supports that they consented to this?
I think that's in the trial transcripts, and Jim Osmond testified on direct and cross-examination that there were meetings, more than one meeting, during his tenure with Carlin and Associates. All the agents assigned to that office at that time knew of the policy, knew what was required, knew it was mandatory, knew it had to be followed. And in one particular instance, I think it's on cross-examination of my client by Mr. Oliver, who was assisting Ms. Dorsett at the trial. He said we had a meeting, and we split lines of authority, and I believe that's somewhere in the transcript around page 150, 160, somewhere in there, but it is in there. We split lines of authority, and if we ever come across the client of another, we split the case. I submit to you there is mutual assent. There's a meeting of the minds. Gary Peterson was there. Dean Carlin was there. Jim Osmond was there. And it's his testimony that they agreed that this is how they were going to manage Carlin and Associates and all the agents working out of that office. I submit to you that's mutual assent. And I believe that's what the judge found. And as I previously stated, I think the judge did an excellent job of analyzing this case, looking at the evidence, gauging the credibility of the witnesses, their demeanor at the trial, and we believe it was a good decision and it should be upheld. I'd like to point out a few other things that were raised as the defense to support the defendant's appeal. It's been suggested to you that applying Osterkamp to the facts and circumstances of this case would create a dangerous precedent. I submit to you that that should not be a consideration at all. Osterkamp does apply to this case. It will not set a dangerous precedent because, if anything, you're following the precedent. We're following the precedent set by this court. This court has said many times, if an employer and workers associated together have policies, they are to be followed. And if they are specific, they can give rise to contractual contractual relations. That's exactly what happened here. We have a specific policy. Now, the defendants seem to suggest that it didn't apply to Security Mutual products. The judge heard that evidence. He entered several findings of facts and conclusions of law on that issue. And I believe when you read findings of facts and conclusions of law number 28 through 41, the judge was aware of that. He heard the evidence and rejected that argument. The policy clearly applied to Security Mutual business and products. And for example, there's instructions on postage when dealing with Security Mutual mail, telephone privileges back to the home office, and office allocation if you meet or don't meet Security Mutual productivity standards. So the defense that this doesn't apply, this handbook does not apply to a Security Mutual product or the Hellwig sale, is a complete fiction and rejected by the judge. The other issue here I'd like to submit for your consideration, this will not set a dangerous precedent. The defendants in their brief say that applying a contract on these facts and circumstances would create a dangerous precedent because they're independent agents and independent contractors spread out throughout the state or the region. That's, excuse me.
Just take your water up there if you want to.
That's simply not the case on the facts of this case, because we're dealing with a, at this time, a three-person office, three agents working out of the same office in Aberdeen, South Dakota, and then later on during the time frame pertinent to this case, Jim was operating out of his home office, but still associated and an agent with Carlin and Associates. And so this, the affirmance of this case and what happened at the trial court doesn't have any statewide or regional ramifications. It applies to this business, these three agents, and the contractual arrangements by their own policies between them.
Clear up something for me here. Did this happen because these phrases, did Mr. Peterson curious to know if there was a connection between this client and both of these agents, or whether this gear policy was just the idea of defendant and just happenstance they brought to this point.
I think what was testified to at trial, Your Honor, was that Defendant Gary Peterson joined Carlin and Associates sometime in 96 or 1998. Prior to that time, he was employed by a bank in Aberdeen, and the Hellwigs, my clients, or customers, banked at that bank. And Gary Peterson at some point left the bank job, joined Carlin and Associates. They were standing in line at a bank, and Gary Peterson solicited the Hellwigs to the business had just started, and by this point it had gone on by 8 or 10 years. And so then Gary Peterson, while they were standing in line at a bank, solicited the senior Mr. Hellwig, and then
for this gear,
right?
So it was pure happenstance.
It was. I wouldn't say pure happenstance, because obviously Gary had contacted the Hellwigs before, but the business just, we're not ready to do that with our money yet, and then later on he approached him again. So I think it was the intent of Defendant Peterson to solicit the Hellwigs. Now, there's also testimony, to be fair to all sides, that he did not understand that the Hellwigs were active clients of my client, Jim Osmond. But that was brought up later on in plenty of time for Jim to assist on the sale and was prevented from doing so. Well, I don't have much further to say other than this board has the briefs and the reply brief, a full transcript of what happened at trial. We think it was based on the evidence. The verdict by the trial court was sound in all respects, should be affirmed. On behalf of my client, I'd like to thank the Supreme Court and opposing counsel for the opportunity to be heard on this very important issue. And thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Spears. Ms. Dorsett, you have 10 minutes.
Just a couple points in response. I would again remind the court that none of the rulings rendered, I suppose, against the plaintiff in this case was appealed. So as to any ruling that dismissed Dean Carlin as a defendant, dismissed Carlin Associates as a defendant, was not appealed from. Furthermore, the 60-40 split of commissions was not appealed by the plaintiff either. So if this court believes that the commission split was improperly applied, I would submit that the court cannot revert back and find 50-50, because, again, the plaintiff never appealed from that trial court ruling.
So you're saying that if we rule against you on the merits of the case, but we reach the damages, we can't go back up to 50, but we can go down to 20?
That's what I would submit. Also, I would want to point out that Dean Carlin has agents spread all over the state. He's a general agent who's recruited and trained many agents, and they did not have to work out of his building in Aberdeen. They only did that if they chose to. He had agents in Rapid City. He had agents in Bowbridge. You'll see through the trial transcript that he had agents working out of their home.
Well, isn't that the point, though? You know, SDCL 5313 deals with implied contracts. I'm sure you've read it. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yes.
I mean, it specifically says that an implied contract can be formed or manifested by the conduct of the parties. And here, the fact that Mr. Carlin had agents all over the state is one thing. But what happened, these are agents that chose to work together in this office with this manual out there. Isn't that the conduct that the trial court was relying on to find an implied contract?
Perhaps, but that was wholly an error. And here's why. Because, again, we have to look at mutual assent, an essential element of an implied contract, and the unrefuted testimony at trial, both by the plaintiff and defendant Gary Peterson, is that they had two completely opposite, divergent views of what the manual did and what the manual applied to. That in and of itself is a complete lacking of mutual assent in this case. Defendant Gary Peterson said, no, that paragraph never applied to me if I'm selling security financial products. And I would first of all go back even a step further. The manual was not a contract in the sense that it mandated anything. It was just a guidebook, a recommendation to agents. If you happen to come across a prior client of another agent, we want you guys to get along. Will you please sit down and will you please discuss it and figure out a way, if you can, to split these commissions? If they chose not to do that, again, the remedy was disassociation. The manual did not mandate a disciplinary process if you failed to do that. It did not have any appeal process. The manual did not say if you can't agree, Dean Carlin is going to be the final say in this. That was completely lacking, which in and of itself suggests it was merely a guideline, merely a suggestion or a recommendation. And if an agent continually caused problems in that area, Dean Carlin would choose to boot that agent from his office or his association. Mind you, he could not take the contract away from them to sell insurance, however.
Did the trial court make a determination about credibility? I mean, we often get cases where one side says, no, we never had a deal, the other side says, yes, we did. The trial judge has to decide who's more.
That's a very, very good point. What the trial court did, and that brings up a point from opposing counsel, the trial court rejected Dean Carlin's saying that the manual only applied to Carlin Associates. There is no finding of fact or conclusion of law that rejects Gary Peterson's version of what he thought happened, and there is no conclusion rejecting his testimony. There's also no conclusion or finding rejecting the testimony of Dwayne Storley, who had the exact same understanding of the manual as Gary Peterson. Now,
well, but just a minute, though. A fact finder, whether it be a jury or a judge, they don't have to enter a finding rejecting everything in the case. They merely have to adopt findings supporting the ultimate ruling of the court.
There's no finding either way as to Gary Peterson. His understanding or his assent as to this manual is found nowhere in the findings or conclusions. I think what we're doing here is by some stretch, maybe the most culpable party here is Dean Carlin for creating and drafting a manual that, whether inadvertent or otherwise, created a certain impression in the plaintiff, James Osmond. So let Dean Carlin and James Osmond deal with that. But Dean Carlin was dismissed completely as a defendant, and this innocent third party over here, Gary Peterson, is left holding the bag.
Of course, Gary Peterson could have cross-claimed for Gary Peterson against Dean Carlin if you think that he's the wrongdoer.
I would submit that the only theory pled in this case was breach of contract. If it was pled under perhaps an insurance law type situation where you're suing under a third party beneficiary theory, maybe that would have been the case, but that wasn't done here. We have a right to defend the case on the way it's pled and tried, which is breach of contract. I submit that was probably the improper theory, but nonetheless, that's what we defended on. It wasn't our decision. So we're left with the record, we're left with how it was pled, we're left with how it was tried, and it was completely improper under the facts and the applicable law in South Dakota.
Well, you wouldn't want to sue Dean and Carl anyway. You agreed to your client.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would submit that the only party in this case that had the version of the manual and the facts was James Osborne. Nobody else testified that they believed this case was applied the way that he did. What the trial court did is adopted James Osmond's belief as to the contract terms and applied them to an innocent third party, which is the error here.
Let's go back to damages for a minute. Give me your argument as to why you think damages, if the verdict goes, if the decision goes against you, why it should be less than 80-40, 60-40.
What would have happened in this case had, first of all, I would point out for the record that Gary Peterson testified this policy was sold by him, I believe, in March when he met Dennis Helwig. He had known Dennis Helwig for about 10 years, and he'd been continually calling him saying, "You're ready to do gear yet? You're ready to do gear yet?" Finally, one day in the bank when they're standing in line together, Dennis is like, "You know, as a matter of fact, I am. Let's meet. And I believe they met either a couple days later or a week later. Policy was signed and sold at that point in time. All the other documents that you will see were executed throughout the summer months and the early fall were just components of the original contract. So at the time that James Osmond found out that the Helwigs were working with Gary Peterson, we submit was in September. The work was already done. And with the manual, again, was a guideline to the agents. Will you guys please sit down and create a contract between yourselves working this out? Gary Peterson testified he never would have agreed to split commissions with James Osmond because, again, James did not generate any interest in this product. He never introduced these two parties to each other. He never in any way, shape, or form made the referral. And he certainly would have not have been able to offer any meaningful assistance because he didn't understand gear. He admitted he didn't understand gear and that he never sold it. So at the very least, if Gary had to have something imposed upon him, it would be more akin to a referral type relationship, which would be 80-20.
Thank you.
If anything. And then I would, for the last part, point out that opposing counsel brought up balancing of the equities, and that's how the court came about the 60-40 split. I would point out, however, that this remedy is precluded under the doctrine of unclean hands. James admitted in paragraph 11 of his own complaint that when he found out that Gary Peterson had sold gear to the Helwigs, he was going to get that policy dropped.
You know, that issue really wasn't discussed in the opening by you or in rebuttal, so I don't know if that is that proper rebuttal.
I believe it is, but I would just submit in response to the equity argument here that we can't have equitable arguments if we have a defendant who acted in bad faith and with improper motive.
Are
you
done?
Thank you.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes, and at that time we'll take up our next case.